Dr. Craig, significant and well-attended debates have been continuing in your work. We're going to talk a little bit about some debates that you've had recently. By the way, if you go to reasonablefaith.org, some of these debates are available on audio and video. And in the case that those are not there, there's also some descriptions of them in our newsletter. So just go to the newsletter and you can read some quick accounts of what took place at some of these debates. Let's start with Victor Stinger. This is not the first time that you've debated him. Contrast the two debates that you had.
Sure. Vic Stinger and I debated a number of years ago at the University of Hawaii, where he was an emeritus professor of physics. And that was a debate on the existence of God. And it went very well. I think the Christian side emerged clearly victorious. Although Stinger, I understand, has in recent years done a little bit of revisionist history on the debate. But fortunately, the tape is available and anyone can watch the DVD to form his own opinion. But I was happy to have a rematch with him at Oregon State University for the Socratic Club at the university. And our topic again was the existence of God. And Stinger had published some more recent books since our previous debate, and so I took the time to read those or the relevant portions of them.
God, and the failed hypothesis, I believe, is one of them?
Yes, that's right. That's okay. Right. And gives his reasons for thinking that God does not exist. And so I was prepared to respond to those arguments as well as to offer some arguments myself for God's existence.
And he's a physicist.
That's right.
So I think the debate's probably centered on some of those points on the Big Bang and creation of the universe and so on?
Well, I did bring up the cosmological argument based on the origin of the universe, but it was surprising, frankly, how weak Stinger was in his own area of expertise in the physics. I think that since his retirement, he perhaps hasn't kept abreast of developments, and so as a result, he really had very little to say about the origin of the universe other than to appeal to the Hartle-Hawking model back from 1983, and didn't seem to be apprised of more recent developments.
In this second debate, you changed it up a little bit just to keep things fresh.
Right. Having been to India in February and had the experience of speaking on the existence of God there and noticing the very positive response I got to the ontological argument, I thought, well, let's try the ontological argument out in a debate. I have never done this before because the argument's so abstract that students are apt either not to understand it or to think that it's some kind of a trick. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, why not? If it's part of a cumulative case, let's throw in the ontological argument. And then because of time constraints, I had to cut somewhere else. So I cut the fine-tuning argument and put in a short version of Leibniz's argument from contingency, that God is the best explanation for why there is something rather than nothing. And then I went with my usual moral argument and the argument from the historicity of Jesus' resurrection. So it did have some new elements in it, and those new elements, I think, made it a great deal of fun. After the debate, I ran into Stinger back at the hotel. He was in the bar having a drink, and he said to me, "You didn't use the same arguments this time." He said, yeah. You didn't use the fine-tuning argument. And I said, no, I thought I'd mix it up a little bit, make it fresh. And so
no wonder he was having a drink. I mean,
he was definitely off balance in the debate, I think.
Well, he basically argued one thing. If God existed, he would provide good objective evidence for his existence,
right?
Which he hasn't,
right?
According to Stinger.
Yeah, so it was an argument from the absence of evidence, but it was an attempt to push that argument a little bit farther, not simply saying there's no evidence that God exists, but attempting to say if there were a God, then there would be such evidence. And in fact, in his book, Stinger gives a list of 11 different observations which would make it probable that God exists if we were to have these sort of observations. And so he thinks that if there were a God, this is what we ought to expect to see. We don't see that. Therefore, it's highly probable that God does not exist.
Well, in other words, God needs to reveal himself in the way that I think he should.
Yes, that's the presumptuousness of the argument, Kevin. That's one of the problems with it, is that it is very presumptuous in saying that I know that if there were a God, then this is what he ought to have done. He ought to have met my standards for his evidential presence. And that is a very presumptuous way of arguing. It might be that God has quite different motives or purposes in mind than you would. And in fact, I did attack that first premise, that if God existed, then he would provide good objective evidence to everyone of his existence. I gave two reasons for thinking that may not be true. But in a sense, that was just an aside. I just said that in passing. My main attack came upon the premise that he hasn't provided good objective evidence, because I think that he has. But I think, in fact, both premises in Stenger's argument are dubious.
Any one of those 11 compelling?
Well, as I looked at them, I thought that at least seven out of the 11 are fulfilled, and that therefore God has done a very good job of meeting Stenger's criteria. One was, for example, that the universe would have come into existence without any sort of discernible natural cause of its origin. Well, that is certainly suggested by modern cosmology. Another was that the universe would exhibit a sort of order and complexity that natural science couldn't explain. And that's certainly true of the fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe. And so with several other of the 11 conditions that he laid down. In one sense, Stenger played right into my hands, in that I was offering arguments and evidence for God's existence that made that second premise just evidently false. That premise, again, being that there is no objective good evidence for God's existence. So it served to focus the debate on the arguments for God's existence that I was giving. Because if Stenger can't answer those, then his second premise is automatically falsified.
And I applaud Dr. Stenger. At least he tried to name some things, because we often challenge our atheist friends, okay, well, name me one thing that you think God should have done that he hasn't to reveal himself, and so on. And many are trying to list some things. And one atheist friend of mine said, well, you know, now that we have electron microscopes, if we were to look at each individual cell and it said on there, made by Yahweh, he said, you know, God could have easily just done that, and then we'd see that. And I said, kind of like made in China? Is that what you're trying to say? And
I wonder if God would do that in English.
Yeah, or if he would write it in Hebrew. That's another thing. Well, when you see it, then it would translate immediately. God could do that. But my question back to him was, if you were to see that, would that necessarily make you want to have a relationship with God, or would just force you to believe in his existence? Or how do you know that alien life, aliens from another planet, didn't put that on there to fool us? And so God has done so much better than stamping each atom with made in China.
Yeah. You know. And Stenger's argument is not that God could have made his existence more evident. That's not his argument. I think his argument is better than that. His argument is that if there were a God, then we ought to expect to see some sort of good objective evidence of his being. And that doesn't require that there couldn't be greater evidence. That would allow you to have, in a sense, an ascending scale that maybe is endless. God could have always made his existence more obvious. But Stenger isn't requiring that. He's simply saying there ought to be some good objective evidence that he exists, if God did exist. Now, I don't think that premise is clearly true. I think there are reasons to think that if God exists, he might well have reasons for not doing that. But in any case, that aside, I think that God certainly has met Stenger's criteria for his existence being reasonable, namely that there is good objective evidence that God exists. And similarly, the argument that God could have provided greater evidence of his existence, and that therefore that somehow provides a reason to think he doesn't exist, that again is not Stenger's argument, but you will hear that said by certain atheists. So there's a whole mix of these kinds of arguments based on absence of evidence or degree of evidence, and it's important to see exactly which one our opponent is offering. And fortunately, Stenger makes his premises explicit. He states them very clearly in his book, and that makes it easier to respond.
After these debates, it would seem that some dialogue would be opened up between you and some of your opponents, because after all, Bill, they are colleagues. And are there further exchanges to maybe try to get at truth? Because it can become a contest. And if they continue to view you as a contestant, well, then they may be resistant to any insights that you have, when instead they might ought to try to incorporate your work with theirs.
Yes, I don't see any movement in that direction, Kevin. I'm not engaged in any sort of personal dialogue with these folks, other than just published responses and counter responses. So I don't see any interest from the folks that I've debated in further dialogue on these subjects.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I suppose it's a bad thing for them spiritually, I think. Unfortunately, it's not a good sign.
Because you could offer them some spiritual things, you could offer them some insight.
Well, it would show that they're open, at least, to the existence of God.
Maybe get on a personal level, too.
If these people's arguments are really as bad as I think they are, and as they seem to be in the debates, then their lack of openness is troubling, because the arguments have been devastated for unbelief, but doesn't seem to make any difference.
I will suggest that, in many ways, it's not necessarily a bad thing, because these issues are often best hashed out in public forums and public discourse, where you really try to get at the crux, and the heat of it all tends to bring the main issues to the surface. And so I would suggest that. I would see that there's a lot of value in what you do in responding to journals, responding to articles, responding to one another in written form and in public forums.
Right. So, that's where the debate is carried on, and students who view the debates can see what are some of the arguments for theism, what are some of the arguments for atheism, and then how would proponents of these differing views respond to these arguments, and then they can weigh the cogency of these responses.
Dr. Craig, as we wrap up today, I do want you to mention your opportunity to speak to the professors at the Harvard Faculty Club. And when I heard you were going to do that, I did think of Daniel in the Lion's Den, in one sense, because it's Harvard. In another sense, I was totally confident, and they definitely needed to hear from you.
Yeah, these were two extraordinary evenings that we had in Boston. The first one was at the Harvard Faculty Club, where I talked about God as a foundation for morality. And there I did have a respondent. Her name is Ray Langton, and she is an atheist or agnostic philosopher who was raised by Christian missionary parents in India, or rather in a boarding school in India. She was sent away from home at 5, and she told us about how she was raised in this very authoritarian boarding school. And unfortunately, it seemed to just turn her against religious belief, so that she thinks religion now is positively detrimental to the moral life, because it just tells you to do things or God is going to get you. That's what religion does. And so it was sad to see the kind of emotional baggage that she still carries from her childhood about this. But we had a good exchange about whether or not God can be the ground of morality. She raised the Euthyphro argument, as you might expect. But it was a good evening. And then the next evening was at MIT at the Faculty Club. And there I was paired with Avi Loeb and Howard Smith, two cosmologists, talking about the Kalam cosmological argument and the origin of the universe. Smith is a Jewish believer, he's a theist, and Loeb is an agnostic, but open. And so we had a wonderful dialogue, and they were fully in agreement with the science that was presented. And so it was a very charitable evening, and the physicists in the audience, I think, were especially appreciative of the approach that I took.
On our next podcast, I want to explore some more debates that you've had recently, and I promise they're going to be interesting.
Sure.
Well, thank you so much for listening to Reasonable Faith, and we'll be adding new podcasts each week, so be sure you come back. Finally, thank you so much for your financial support. This keeps the ministry of Reasonable Faith expanding. You know, even the name Reasonable Faith gets so many people's attention. They often assume that faith in God is not reasonable or supported by facts and evidence. The name alone can break down unnecessary barriers and bring people to Dr. Craig's work on these crucial questions of life. So check out reasonablefaith.org, click through all the great resources there, and if you wish, you can safely donate there as well. It would be a blessing. We appreciate it. I'm Kevin Harris. We'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig.